Welcome to North Beats from North Beach Podcast. I'm your host, Corey Luna. On today's episode, I speak with Mark Letzner of Electric Kitchen. We discuss his work with Serge Modular Music Systems. We talk about the live tour he did earlier this year on the East Coast. And we talk about the tracks that you'll hear later at the end of the episode on how he composed them. And before we get into the episode, a couple announcements. Every month, if you're here in the Bay Area, you can hear live electronic music. We've got Resident Frequencies on the first Sunday of every month, Resident on the second Tuesday of every month, and Peaked on the third Wednesday of every month. Check out patreon.com for North Beats to contribute. And you can always find me at Corey Z. Luna on Instagram. Mark, thanks so much for coming over and doing my podcast. Really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Be happy to.
Good. How was lunch?
Lunch was good, but you know, what's wrong with green curry? Nothing, ever.
That's right.
Always good. It's always the good choice.
Can't mess it up. So, Mark, tell me a little bit about Electric Kitchen. What does that encompass entirely?
So, over the last couple of years, I had taken a very long hiatus from making music, and when I got back into making music, I was just playing improv with some friends, and I was doing, then that group was kind of putting stuff together. And long story short is, I ended up doing a whole variety of musical activities, and we needed a name to put over it. And so that's where Electric Kitchen came from, so that became the name. But the project has grown from what was originally just the name of some music that a group of us were doing as improv to, it's become sort of the overall project of all my musical activity. So I put everything under the Electric Kitchen label or name as a place to hold it all. So it's not really an artist name, it's more of, I call it the sort of musical project name.
Okay, yeah, similar to a label or a brand?
I guess it's sort of, a little like a label or a publishing company or something like that.
Okay. All right, very good. And because when I first started, when I first got to know you, mm-hmm. Maybe over a year ago now, I knew you as performing as Electric Kitchen.
Right. So when I do my live performances solo or with improv groups, some members who I've done a bunch with, we generally perform under that as a name for the ensemble or for the group. I've done some work with, in one case, there's a musician in New Zealand I work with, and there's another musician and composer in San Francisco that I work with. And technically those aren't the Electric Kitchen band or group, but they'll go on the Electric Kitchen website and they'll be under my activity will go there. I also have a bunch of stuff that I would consider sort of very different than the group or performance-oriented work, and I put that under Electric Kitchen as well.
Okay, makes sense. Mm-hmm. Great. Excuse me. And from there, how do you go about publishing your work?
Oh, God, I wish I knew. I mean, it's easy enough to get your music out on all the streaming services. That's relatively straightforward. It's easy enough to get your music out. I put it out on Bandcamp as well. So my stuff is distributed out with DistroKid to all the standard services. It's on Bandcamp, which is kind of my preferred way for people to go find it. Mm-hmm. And then there's a bunch of stuff. Sometimes when there's accompanying video, I'll put a version out on YouTube as well. I also put out a lot of experiments and smaller bits, and I like to put out clips from my weekly rehearsals and stuff. I put that out on both Instagram and Facebook. So I kind of get it out there all those different ways. I guess that's really all more distribution. I really have no idea how to actually publish it in the sense of make it widely viewable and available for people to find it. Like, you know, they can hear it if they know about it, but I have almost no idea how to get people to find it.
I'm perplexed about that as well.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about the background of You mentioned a while ago that you worked with, was it Serge?
Serge Trepnin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And tell me a little, tell me some history on that.
So when I was in college, which was, let's just say it was before MIDI.
Okay.
I studied with a composer, Ivan Trepnin, and I studied electronic music, which is what my degree is in. And it turns out that Ivan Trepnin is the brother of Serge Trepnin, and Serge is the creator of the Serge Modular Analog Synthesizer, which is, I'd say, enjoying a lovely resurgence, pun intended, I guess, recently. Anyway, way back in the 80s, I was studying electronic music with Ivan, and I spent a summer out here in California. I was on the East Coast where I had grown up and gone to school. So I came to California and I spent a couple weeks at CARMA, CCRMA, which is Stanford's computer music facility. I did a 6-week fellowship there. And then I came up to San Francisco to spend time with Serge. And now at that time, Serge modular synthesizers were being made in a Victorian house on Heath Street, which was amazing. And so Serge welcomed me. I actually lived in his house. And I didn't work on the Serge analog production, which was on the like middle two floors of the building, because he had a full, he had a staff that built those things and one with him. But I was working with Serge on two separate digital music hybrid projects, neither of which in the end ever saw the light of day, sadly. But we, I spent another 6 weeks of that summer, the other half of that summer, working directly with Serge on figuring out digital control of various analog circuits and writing a lot of software to run it. And it was a really interesting, wonderful time. Unfortunately, Ivan has passed, but I remain friends with Serge to this day, which is really lovely.
Is he still in the Bay Area?
Oh, no, no. He's in France.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They're originally from France.
So. Okay. I did not know that. Yeah. That's quite an experience.
Yeah, no, it was it was wonderful.
Were you? Did you? Do you still have any modules from then? Or?
Oh yeah, yeah. So actually, at that time, I was in college, and I, as much as I loved them, I couldn't actually afford them, right? Because even then, they were expensive. And so, a couple years later, when I moved to California for my first job, and I had finally gained some capital, saved up, I actually went back to Serge and was like, okay, I'm ready. And so I ordered my Serge. At that time, you used to, you picked which modules you wanted out of the catalog and you assembled them into what racks you wanted. And then they custom built you a front panel just for that. And so,
wow.
And in my case, I bought them all as kits because you could, even back then, this was like 1989, maybe, you could buy them as kits as an option. And so, they made you custom front panels, and then they sent you all the kits. And I spent probably 4 months soldering the thing together.
Wow.
And yeah, no, I still have it. So I have a 3-rack Serge.
Wow.
That I built from the era, you know, delivered directly from Serge himself.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So. That's something that I would love to hear someday.
Oh, there are some recordings of it online. I play it.
Yeah.
I don't play it a lot these days, mostly because I'm working on different styles of music and it's not necessarily amenable to most of my projects, but occasionally I do. So I think there are two Serge pieces that are out there from the last year that I've done.
Excellent.
So yeah, there was one from just this past spring. So
now, last month you and Lachlan Fletcher played at Peaked.
Yes.
And Lachlan had a Serge.
Yes.
What version of Serge was that?
I believe his version is what's called, I think what he has is Eurosurge. I'm not sure exactly which version. So, Surge modules have sort of interesting sort of lore and evolution. When Surge originally, I mean, you can find some of this online if you want a deeper history, but very briefly, Surge developed them when he was at CalArts, and they were designed very much as to be kits and to be an affordable synthesizer. I think at one point he was using the term the people synthesizer. then through the 80s, Surge was both manufacturing them, both selling them as completed units and as kits. You could buy them either way. And then at some point, Serge decided it was time to move on, and he passed on, or I don't know the business arrangements, but there was another company called STS that was manufacturing or making them in Oakland, as well as repairing them, and as well as developing a few new modules. And so there's the STS era. And then this thing happened where no one paid any attention to analog modular at all. I can remember the, you know, it was like somewhere in the, you know, mid 90s or late 90s, you know, until God, probably about 2010, you know, no one paid any attention to analog modular. And I would occasionally haul this thing out and people were like, what is that dinosaur you've got there? So nothing happened. But meanwhile, a few people began to reverse engineer circuits and build kits or equivalent circuits. And so now there's about five or six different places where you can get Serge modules, although not technically from Serge himself, you know, where people have reproduced the circuits or reproduced the circuits with modern available electronics. Sometimes people have done them in Eurorack format. Some of them have done them in still banana format, but in a smaller case size. There's a bunch of varieties. And then there's a few companies actually going at it, like Random Source is the big one, wow. One of the two. So there's a bunch of varieties, you know, but all of them are trying to keep to this. I mean, Serge modules have a somewhat different philosophy than others. And so they're all sort of working within that sensibility.
Hmm. That makes sense. Yeah. Just do it.
It's fine.
Good boy. And I'm curious, was there any, what was it like living at the Serge house on Haight Street?
It was great. I mean, it was an environment in which, you know, everyone was, you know, turning, you know, like living their passion. I know that sounds like a really quaint phrase to say, but it's true. I mean, you know, we enjoyed, you know, folks. I mean, not everyone who worked there lived there. There was a few people who did actually on the ground floor. Basically there was this crazy thing we were all passionate about, making electronic music with, you know, these strange devices, and people were soldering them and enjoying them. So I guess it felt like we were all involved in this great conspiracy, which we enjoyed greatly. This weird place. Serge himself is just a wonderful, delightful person. And so he was, I had a great time with him. So it was a lot of fun. They had a huge white dog that shed everywhere. There was white dog hair everywhere.
Like a Samoyed or like a...
Yeah, something like that. Giant Samoyed or something. It was huge.
Very nice. Now, tell me a little bit about the music you were making back then.
It was very different than what I do now. So first of all, as I said, I started studying electronic music before the era of MIDI. I was studying mostly on Serge, although I had experience in both Buchla's and Moog as well. But these are the early patchable Moogs, not the keyboard Moogs. And doing, you know, tape work, you know, cutting and splicing tape and building physical tape loops to get, you know, looping to happen. I was very interested in how I could, I wanted to augment the analog systems with a more complex way of controlling them. And I wanted to use a computer to do that. But at the time, there was no MIDI. And so what I ended up doing was working with Dave Wilson, who did some work with Serge as well, to build a interface between an Apple II, now you know what era we're talking about, an Apple II computer and the Serge. And so I had control voltages in both directions that I could send, and I had triggers in both directions. And what I would do is I would write a lot of very algorithmic music on the Apple II that would generate sequences of, it had a tone generator card as well. So it could generate, you know, it had some oscillators and it had control voltages and pulses. And then I would send all that to the Serge, where I would then further process what was going on, or have the computer, I wouldn't say sequence, because this is live algorithmic music where the computer is constantly recomputing what to do next based on some algorithm. So, you know, it's not sequenced in the sense that it's pre-written. And so I would use that as kind of a giant augmented instrument. Like there's a piece I wrote called Bounce, not very creative name, in which my only input to the system was a telegraph key. And so I would play a telegraph key into rhythmically into the computer, and the computer would interpret that and generate a whole series of tones and control voltages and would control the surge. And then the surge had this giant patch on it. And that's what you heard. So I was doing a lot of these algorithmic pieces. There was a piece based on the moon, on the motions of the moons of Mars, and there was a piece based on neural networks and a whole variety of them. And again, they basically, they worked with what I wanted to have happen. Even back then, I liked playing live, or I wanted things to be live performed versus tape. You know, none of us had computers powerful enough to actually compute audio in real time. So that wasn't an option. So I did these sort of augmented control pieces.
Wow. And you were performing them live?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'd perform them live in Boston.
Wow. Okay. Jesus. Did you need like a van to carry all this equipment, or did it fit into a car?
Oh yeah, it was crazy. I mean, it was insane.
I'm imagining it. It's like just from the, you know, the era, I'd imagine you need a van for all that stuff.
Well, I don't know if you need a van, but I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, I was carrying an Apple II computer and this giant interface card and these sort of very sketchy electronics, and and then you had the surge, you know, multiple panels of surge and whatever else. Wow. Yeah, it was an ordeal.
Yeah, because, you know, I know what it's like to gig with a band, but, you know, to do that, you know, it's much more complicated than what it, you know, than how I strip down my modules today. Uh-huh. You know, and so it's, you know, it's big difference just in the technologies, though, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's I had studied, as I said, under Ivan Trepnin, and, you know, he came from a very performance-oriented tradition. All of his works for electronics and generally traditional instruments are all shocking. So I studied with Ivan Trepnin, who came from a very performative tradition, and all his works for electronics and mostly traditional instruments were all written to be played live. And so that's the tradition under which I studied. We did make tape pieces in that electronic music studio, but we mostly, you know, tried to figure out how we could do things so that we could perform them. Because that's, it's not, I find it a very compelling aspect of music that, music performed and appreciated or listened to live is a different context than making music that is recorded and then listened to off a recording. You know, we can talk about the relationship, you know, the live interplay between the performer and the audience. But even in cases where, you know, you're on a big stage and far from the audience, you can't really interact that much with them, especially if you have a ton of electronics that are like super delicate and you're terrified you're going to fall apart at any moment. On the context that the listener is in and how they are approaching the music, and the context in which the musician is in, is just deeply different than in a studio and recording setting. And I think it produces a different style of music. It's a different musical thing. And that's a thing I really like. I like being on either side of that. So with
performing back then to compared to now, what's the time period of what were you doing in between, like say like when I met you and you went and did this tour?
Oh. Okay, so there's a long period in between in which I actually didn't make very much music at all. Part of it's because I came to Silicon Valley and I actually started working in digital audio professionally. I worked at Apple. I worked on the sound systems in early Macintosh computers. And, you know, I spent my whole day doing digital audio engineering and kind of was done with it. So I took up conga drumming, of all things. And I didn't really make much electronic music for many, many, like a good 15 years. But then I came back to it. You know, there's a whole period in electronic music where, you know, the instruments that are primarily available are generally very geared towards keyboard players. And yes. I'm not a keyboard player. I'm not a keyboardist at all. My 2 years of piano as a 10-year-old just never stuck. And it's really only, I don't know, you could probably say, I mean, there's smatterings of it earlier, but the last 15, 20 years have seen a big renaissance or increase in musical device, electronic musical devices with other modes of interaction and expression. And I don't mean just like MIDI controllers with, you know, funny controls. You know, things like, you know, Electron and the notion we have a sort of more broad range of what you might call desktop synthesizer module units. We have, I mean, now I can get a Raspberry Pi that can do far more live audio processing than, you know, than the entire Stanford computer music facility had back in the 80s. I mean, it's, so the ability to do the kind of work that I do, but do it now with both more commercially available instruments or and to do it with easily available tools is completely changed. And so when I met you, I'd come back to electronic music to find that, like, wow, the stuff I had only dreamed of being able to do or had to cobble together hard was now, like, available. You know, and so in fact, you know, my normal rig that I play is my primary live performance instrument these days is an Electron Digitakt sampling percussion synthesizer, and then I run that through a Raspberry Pi with a Pi Sound audio card, and I do a huge amount of processing of the audio in Super Collider, all in software. But I do that all live, and I now have easily available like MIDI control surfaces that I can pipe into that to control that. And so I don't know that my rig is really that much smaller in terms of number of boxes and things I have to plug together, but I have much more power at my hands now than I had before.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there's definitely a, you know, big comparison compared to probably what, you know, the equipment you were using, you know, back when you were working with Serge compared to, say, last month when you played at Peaked, and you just have a table with, you know, a few electronic pieces, you know, chained together.
All right. I'm just trying to think of how to characterize the difference. I mean, it's kind of funny because when we played at Peaked, right, Lachlan basically was performing, you know, the way I used to perform. You know, he had, you know, about four racks worth of analog modular equipment.
Well,
for one of the two pieces, and like he spent his entire time just, you know, twiddling knobs and patch cables. Whereas I sort of went in the other direction. There's, you know, back in the 80s, you had to build everything up from scratch yourself because there just really wasn't that much available out there. And so now we have this great ability that we can lean on, or we can grow musically on top of, you know, great instrument makers. You know, the relationship between the luthier and the performer is, you know, it's always there, and it's we get great power now, right? So I can get something like a Digitakt, which is allowing me to do the kind of sample manipulation that was, even in the 90s when I had a Roland sampler that I was trying to do stuff with, it was like, it was just so much harder to do what I can do on that device now. It's just the device has more power, and, you know, you stand on the shoulders of people who put in all that time and effort to make that thing usable, which is great. You know, you stand on the shoulders of any instrument maker.
Yes.
So, yeah.
No, that's a great comparison because, you know, for example, I've got a Korg Triton for that I bought in 2000, and it takes floppies.
Right.
I'm not taking that anywhere.
All right.
It lives in the studio. It doesn't go anywhere.
All right.
You know, it's certainly not portable like a Digitakt.
Right. Yeah, so for me, I really like the portability. You've probably heard me because I say it way too much. You know, I sort of have this rule that if I'm performing live, I have to be able to get all the equipment from the car to the venue in one trip.
Yes.
And so far, I'm crossing my fingers here. Like, I've been able to do that. Yes. So that's part of that is just a really good constraint. It's really tempting to buy every box out there, and it's really tempting to put them all on the table, and it's really tempting to turn them all on. And I see people do that, and it's all fine, all good. Like, there's nothing wrong. If that's what floats your boat, go for it. But I like being able to dive deeply into the devices that I choose to play. And if I have too many things out there, I find if I have too many boxes, I put each box to one obvious purpose, and then I let it do its thing, obviously, and then I move on to the other box. And it can be all good, but I find for me, I it means I tend to, okay, well, now I have 12 things all doing their obvious. Oh yeah, that thing's really good at doing, like, you know, your basic, you know, kick, thap, whatever, you know, beat you've got going. So that's all it's doing, because I've got 12 other boxes to work with, you know. Whereas if I restrict myself down really strong, that really allows me to focus on the instrument, in that one instrument. So I typically these days play with only one or two audio sources at all. Usually the Digitact, and sometimes I use a Micromonsta sometimes, and sometimes I use an Ovation circuit just to have a few extra voices and some tonal voices.
Watching you perform live is really fun.
Oh, yay!
Just so you know, because it's great, because you're where I want to be musically, because I love that you have everything stripped down to minimized amount of setup. Uh-huh. You've got, you know, the Digitact, you've got the Novation, you've got the, what is it, the Jambi?
Jambe.
The Jambe, yeah. You know, playing the Taiko drum set right in there, which you do live, and you're on point with your time. It's great. And I really appreciate it and enjoy seeing that setup, because that's something that I aspire to with the things that I'm doing, which is obviously different because I'm using different equipment. I'm going with the whole Eurorack style. But I'm trying to break it down to the point where I can throw everything into a backpack or a small portable suitcase and not have to carry around, lug around any more equipment than that.
Right.
You know, take a bus to the show is my plan.
Right.
So, and I can't bring everything on the bus.
Right. No, you have to have it very, very clear. I think the act of performing live is, you know, we focus, and probably mostly and rightly so, on, you know, the actual musical performance. But I like to think that there are all these other aspects of it which must also are part of what makes the whole happen. And that includes things I practice tearing down and setting up my equipment. I actually practice it with a timer.
Wow.
My goal is always to have the gig, you know, the rig up and going within 15 minutes of opening the bag.
Did you take drama class at some point in time?
I didn't actually take drama classes.
Sounds like drama class.
But there's this sense of, like, it's just as much, especially if you're an electronic musician, where so much about electronic music is about connections and interactions between pieces and understanding the flow of your equipment, right? It's not, you know, if you own a cello, you take the equipment out of its case, you know, and you pay attention to the position of the bridge, and you make sure the strings are right, and you make sure there's enough rosin or on your bow, and things are tight and where you want them. But, you know, you pay attention to the equipment, but that's all the equipment you have to pay attention to. You're done. Now it's all music. We play electronics, right? Whether it's Eurorack or synthesizers or whatever it is, there's, like, you know, 415 more things you have to, you know, have to all be right for it to all happen.
Yes.
And I don't think I'm actually exaggerating. I mean, it's really, like, you know, amazing really number are. Of settings and all. And so in the same way that you have to be able to pull your cello out and get it into performance, you gotta be able to do that with your equipment too. So I feel it's really, it behooves you to really deeply understand your equipment. Not, you know, it's your instrument. You got to understand its care and feeding and it's how you put it together. You can't be like, I don't know, I just put it out. Like, no, you got to know it. So, like, you know, I carefully, like down to, like, okay, I have, like, the purple bag has all the equipment, has all the cables that go on the table. And then, like, the other bag has the cables that, like, go from the equipment out to the house. You know, everything is just carefully sorted. It's all in order so that I can bring it all together and bring it all back out.
Yeah, you pretty much already set up. You've got, like, sounds like you've got, like, color coordinated bags of what goes into what bag, so that you when you're ready to go play a show, you know where things are supposed to go.
Yeah, everything has a spot. So in my cases, like everything has a particular spot where it goes. It's also really good. You know, we play a lot of these in San Francisco. We're blessed. We have, you know, 2 monthly group shows. And yes, if you play at them, they're wonderful. But, you know, when it comes time to clean up your equipment, there's like 7 or, you know, sometimes as many as 10 other musicians busy trying to clean up their electronic equipment, yes, at the same time. So like knowing where all your equipment goes and it goes back in this bag in the exact same way every time, like, or, you know, you practiced it, you know what's there. Make sure you don't leave anything.
Yes. And I've gotten it. So for example, I've gotten in the habit of putting orange tape around all of my cables, yeah, so that I don't get them lost.
Right.
So they don't get lost or no one takes them accidentally because they're all, everyone's cords are black.
Right.
It's like, this is really confusing.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'm always happy to get a gear that is not black,
right,
just because one, it'll be identifiable and I can probably see it actually.
Yeah.
As much as black is a great color, yes, but it's so much easier to see it when it's not.
Yeah. I have identifying tags on all my cables and all my stuff.
Yeah. And I really appreciate that you mentioned that understanding your equipment is extremely vital and key to playing a live show. You know, similar to, you know, understanding your cello and your positions.
Yeah.
That, you know, the better you understand your equipment, that synthesizer, that digital interface, the better your performance is going to be because you already know it, you know, you already have a premeditated idea of how it's supposed to work.
Right.
And how it's supposed to flow. So your performance will come out better that way.
Right. I also think it's, I guess I have 2 thoughts about that. One is, you need to be not in a panicked headspace over your equipment, over your instrument. Your, yeah, instrument has to be like not the worry, right? So you got to make sure that's like, yep, I just do what I do and it'll be there and it does what it does and it works, you know, and I know all the parts and I know where they all go. And so part of it is to make sure that like, that's not, you know, you're not fretting because I don't want to be anxious over whether or not the equipment's working.
Yeah.
The other thing is that it's inevitable that the equipment won't work at some point. It's just, it's 100% inevitable. When I was studying music with Yvonne back in the 80s, I had this, I wrote this first piece I'd ever written for multiple instrumentalists besides myself. And so we had 4 of us up on stage and the 3 other players were all playing electric pianos and I was processing them all digitally and through the Surge and in really janky 8-bit format on a computer as well. It was serious distortion time. And we had a performance and what I didn't find out until, so we had a sound check and it was fine and then it was our time to go up and we went up and what I hadn't anticipated was the previous act had decided that there were too many stage monitors for them. I don't know how you decide there are too many stage monitors. And so they unplugged like almost all the stage monitors.
Oh, no.
Like they didn't ask I don't know how it happened, but that's what happened. And so we got up there and there was just no feedback. And since my other people were playing electric pianos, like it's not like they can hear the instrument, right? So they could barely hear each other because we could only hear each other out of the house, which is really hard. And so, you know, the thing just fell to pieces. I mean, it was a disaster, you know. But, you know, we trucked on because you have to, because you're on stage in front of a bunch of people.
Yeah.
And I came off that concert and Yvonne, my mentor, came up and he's like, well, you're a real musician now, Mark. he's like, don't worry, it happens.
Yep.
And it does. And part of knowing your equipment and your instrument is knowing how to get through those moments live without panicking. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it happens. You know, guitarists break a string, you know, and they,
yeah,
keep going because you're in the middle of the song.
Right. Yes.
You know, you don't just stop like, oops, sorry. I don't know what to do now. I was on tour, as you said, I just got back from my first tour on the East Coast. I guess it was in the first show, I was playing a piece and there's a part where I'm supposed to bring in a particular instrument and I went to play it and it just like wasn't there. Like the sound did not come out. Like I hit the trigger and nothing. Yeah. I'm like, okay, time to work. Like, it's just like, okay, not going to have that piece of, you know, that part of this piece is not going to be there. So just work away around it live. It was fine. I felt surprisingly calm about having that happen. I'm sure.
Good.
10 years ago, I would have been panicked. Now I'm like, okay. So never did figure out why it didn't play. It played the next night. No problem.
I don't know, man.
A volume somewhere was set to zero, and I, you know, live, I didn't have time to. The obvious one didn't fix it, so.
yeah, those things get annoying, but and as you've mentioned before, is that you do a lot of improv with your performances.
Yes.
So with that in mind, you're probably able to easily decide on where else to go when that one trigger of a sample doesn't happen.
Yeah. So improv is relatively new to me, although the pieces I did back in the 80s were all live performance. No, almost nothing was improv. It was all written out, even if it was loosely written out. But I still wouldn't have called it improv the way I do now. In the last couple of years, I've gotten involved in doing improv a lot, a tremendous amount. And what I like about it is there's this... Improv is more about listening than about playing. You know, it's about really hearing how the music is evolving live, and having that sensibility really allows you to negotiate these situations, because like, yes, you're actually listening to the music you're creating. You're not just, you know, not that anyone plays by rote, but you know, you have to be so actively engaged in the act of listening to what you're creating, not just playing it. And so that, yeah, it really does allow you to sort of have that skill of thinking about like, okay, that sound is in there. What do I put in its place? Do I move something up, or where am I going to go next?
With your tour, was it so? Tell me about the purpose of it, and was it something that helped gain an audience and listeners?
I hope so. The purpose, I guess, for me, it's the first time I've ever done a tour as a musician. I'd performed live before, both in the more distant past and more recent past, but I had never really done a tour. You know, a series of concerts. You know, one bang, 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 right after another. We did 6 concerts in 9 days, I guess for me, I felt like it was my learning tour. I wanted to figure out how to do this and push myself to be able to perform on that kind of schedule. My greatest joy in music now is really about performing live. That's what I really want to do most. You know, the recorded and released stuff are the artifacts of live performance for the most part. And so I wanted to sort of, you know, explore and push, can I do this live? Can I really pull off an entire hour-long set, you know, nonstop? Can I fill an audience's ears effectively for an hour that way live? So that was my aim in doing, was basically to like, okay, try this. Can I make this work? Can I figure it out how to make it work? We played 6 concerts in 9 days. We played 6 pieces for a set that lasted, depending on the venue, between an hour to an hour and 20 minutes, depending on what the venue wanted or had. We played, let's see, I guess 3 of the pieces were composed in the sense that we knew what we were going to do and we knew where the music was supposed to go. All of them had some amount of improvisation elements in them, but they were composed. And then 3 of the pieces were very loosely structured in the grand plan and were completely improvised live.
Were you with a group of other musicians, or were you playing with different people throughout every venue?
So 4 of the concerts I did with my really great friend Paul Booser, who was actually at the founding of Electric Kitchen when it was a sort of tight local group. He now lives in Boston, so because I was on the East Coast, that gave us the opportunity for him to join me for... He could make 4 of the concerts. So 4 of them were structured around, it was Paul and I playing together, which is nice. And then 2 of the 6 concerts were myself solo. So I played a slightly different set list for those.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, because I've never done it. I've never gone on tour before, so it's still a new concept to me. Even though I've had many friends in different bands who have done, you know, done tours, things like that, and usually they're, you know, usually going with a group of other, you know, musicians, things like that.
Right.
So it's always an interesting perspective to hear something, you know, unique with what you did, which was basically just hit the road with a set of you know, six concerts set up. Now, did you set those concerts up ahead of time with the the venues?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. No, no. I booked the whole tour myself, which is kind of crazy. I understand, but
it's a lot of work.
It was a lot of work. I'm sure the next time I do it, it'll be, you know, a lot easier. The first time was a lot of work because it's just a lot of coordination. And you know, I booked it like 4 months in advance of the tour. Or maybe three to 4 months out is what it took to be able to get it all to work and come together. Yeah, so I booked it and sort of set up the dates, and you know, I reached out to venues and got venues who agreed to book me. Some of the shows were solo. I was it. You know, I was the bill. Most of them had other acts, and we I worked with the venues to find appropriate opening acts for each show. So in one case I went and found an opening act for two of the shows. I found a local musician, Echonaut, who lives in upstate New York, and he opened for us at two of the shows, which was nice because they were back to back, night to night, and so we got to sort of spend 48 hours with him. He was it was a lot of fun. He opened with Dub Techno set. And then we followed. And so that was kind of fun, kind of touring together.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Very cool. So, wow, that's really great. You were able to book the shows of, and, you know, with the venues and work with them on getting other acts to play with you.
Yeah.
Now, did some venues turn you down?
Oh, well, I mean, they don't turn you down like, say, no, thank you. They just never write back.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I sent out many more probes than responses I got. But
okay.
It's okay, you know. No, no one wrote back to say, how dare you?
Yeah.
I didn't get rejected. I just didn't get answers.
That would be weird for a venue to say that. No, thank you.
never ask me again.
That would be weird.
No, we don't have that.
That's good. No, that's a great experience.
Really it was. I am too, because to my sort of somewhat, I don't know, surprise, it suited me really well. I really enjoyed it. I mean, like, I really... Those 9 days were like this sort of continuous haze of I am in performance mode, you know. You know, even the 2 hour van drives from one, you know, from one city to the next, were kind of this like, okay, we're in suspended animation between sets. So no, I really enjoyed it. It was a very good, strong mental space to be in.
Wow, how did you get prepared for that mental space?
Well. For performance, I you know, I did, like the old joke says, practice, practice, practice. You know, that's what I did.
Very good.
Just you know, probably for a month before the tour, a little over a month before the tour, I sort of came up with the rough outline of the set and what it would be. And then I played the set 5 times a week, you know, in my studio. From beginning to end, in that was important to, like, do it as a, you know, don't stop in the middle, because on stage you don't get a chance to stop in the middle.
Right.
So no, I just a lot of practice, because Paul was in Boston, which is kind of funny. I would, like, record some of my sessions and I would send them to him so that he would have, like, backing tracks to try, or backing parts to work with. And I showed up in Boston a couple days early. So that Paul and I would, and we spent 2 really intensive days, you know, rehearsing and finalizing how everything fit together. So, yeah, it's just doing it a lot. It was the basic way to get in the headspace. The headspace of, like, how to deal with the travel. Well, that was just, I had no way of preparing for that.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
No, that's great. Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, just practice, practice, practice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all you really can do to get ready for a show. That way, you know that how you're going to perform. Very good. What would you do? Say you're going to do another tour next year.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do differently?
Um, Well, I'd like to understand how to promote things better. I just didn't do as good a job as I think one could be done. But maybe the right answer is I need to have someone else help me do that job. So I think that's one thing I would do differently. I'm not afraid to do a little longer of a tour. I mean, a 6-show tour is not particularly long for most band tours. I mean, it's not bad, but it's, so I realize now that I can do it, like, okay, like I can pull off a tour. So, if you're going to do all that work and get it going, then it might as well be, you know, I'd love to do, you know, a 10 or 12 concert tour.
Yeah.
You know, next spring or, you know, I don't know, maybe winter. So I would do that. What else would I do? I don't know. I enjoyed the alternative venues that I picked. So some of the venues were like standard music clubs, but like one venue was a modern dance studio. And that was an awesome space and a great vibe and wonderful people to work with. And that was so enjoyable. And another place was just, it was like the small city's local, like cool art cafe. And it was just, again, it was just a wonderful space and a wonderful vibe. And playing in these kind of slightly alternative music environments was just really, really nice. Suited me really well. I'd love to do more of those.
Nice.
Yeah. So.
Well, that's great to hear that you're doing, you know, kind of, you know, the cafe venues here and there as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So I did two art galleries. Well, one was an art gallery cafe. One was an art gallery. One was a dance studio. Two of them were standard, like, you know, music halls, I guess. And then the third one, the sixth one counting was it's actually a like nightclub in Montreal. That was a little bit different because we were, that concert was actually a showcase of a bunch of musicians, from all over coming together. It was like, I think we had 9 electronic musicians and we put on kind of a showcase evening for that, for which I did a sort of extended set. There's a composer's group that you may know of called the Disquiet Junto.
I don't know them.
Okay. So Disquiet Junto is a sort of experimental group. Every Thursday, a prompt goes out, and the prompts are usually very abstract. You know, and like this week's prompt was, hum some music. Hum some original music, record it, and then make a piece of music out of it. And the prompts go out on Thursday, and your deadline, which I'm putting in air quotes here, is Monday. And it's not a contest, and there's no voting. But people, if you choose to participate that week, you do your thing, and you put your, you know, the tracks are usually 2 to 5 minutes long. And you put them up on a common site, and then we all listen to each other's tracks and, you know, say, oh, that's cool, or can you tell me more about this? And it's just really, really interesting to hear what a whole bunch of, and there's, you know, it's got a worldwide participation.
Wow.
So it's run by Mark Weidenbaum out of San Francisco, actually. He's a local guy. He's a wonderful music reporter and writer and educator. Anyway, so the whole tour started because a group of us from that decided that we wanted to actually get together in person because we only known each other online through our music submissions. So we decided to get together in Montreal. So I think there were about 10 of us who flew into Montreal.
Wow.
And met there, and then we put on a concert there. So
tell me about that show. Was that something a little bit more unique with the material that you guys were playing?
Well, that show, that concert was definitely very varied. I mean, you know, there was, because there was a variety of different styles. There was my music and, you know, there was these guys who did this sort of combined Ableton Live and Eurorack duets. There's some straight Eurorack. There was two guys who did Eurorack sets, but they were very, very different in style. You know, one was very rhythmic and one more atmospheric. I mean, so it was a variety of different styles because it was a variety of different composers. It's not the group isn't based on a single genre. So,
yeah, cool.
Or style. So that was, and that was more of a concert for, you know, for performer, you know, it was a musician's concert, right?
Yes.
You know, the audience was just other musicians, yeah. You know, it's just kind of a different thing.
That sounds very familiar, actually.
Well, it is, you know, as I said, we have these wonderful venues in San Francisco and these monthly events, and they're great, and they, I guess this leads me back to thinking about context of music. When you think about the context in which your music will be heard, to me that there's a really, that influences what you choose to create musically. I don't see that as a problem. I think some people think that's is, but it's not. And so I think about, like, when I was thinking about the tour and putting together the set list that I was going to play, you know, okay, well, what am I going to play to a bunch of people who aren't musicians, to people who probably aren't heavy electronic music listeners? You know, it's going to be more people with a more sort of experimental arts appreciation background, not necessarily musicians. So you think about gearing music that will be receivable in that context. Whereas if you know you're playing to a bunch of other electronic musicians, you can do different things, you know, and that's fine. It's just they're different. It's like, are you writing music to be played, you know, in the background as someone walks around? Is it ambient? Is it part of a gallery show? Is it, or, you know, or all the house lights going to be down and the house is like very hush and the spotlight on you? It's a different music, you know. It's a, you know, yeah. Are you playing music which is going to be, in a club full of, you know, big thumpy bass and people dancing constantly? You're going to write different music for those different contexts.
That's right.
And so I think about that. That's I brought you some pieces of music, as you know, and I think one of the things that illustrates is those musics are kind of for very, they come from different contexts. Like, they're written with different contexts in mind.
So tell me about these tracks that you sent me. 4/4, was it Coil Thump?
Coil Thump. Mechanism.
Mechanism.
And then the and then the other thing. So each of these are all things I've done in the last 8 months or so, just to sort of give representative of kind of stuff I've been working on. So 4/4 came out of one of these Disquiet Junto prompts, it's an algorithmic piece of music in the sense that I came up with an algorithm or a method by which chord progressions are evolved, and a particular way to do that, and then took that and applied it to a bunch of chords, and that's what's there. And it's basically written out. It's the track you hear is just produced in Ableton Live with some sampled and synthesized instruments, but it could really actually be performed on, actually I'd love to have it performed on probably vibraphone and organ, which is sort of an interesting combination. It would be four vibraphones and an organ. It would be very interesting instrumentation. And so that's an example of actually written out music. I mean, sort of composed note by note music. It involves an algorithmic process, you know, so I came up with this sort of method by which I sort of, okay, like once I pick the chords, like how do I get them to do the thing that happens there? In some senses, it's a sketch. It's got 4/4 is what, 2 minutes long or something. It's relatively short. I can easily envision it, or I'm thinking it would make a great first section out of maybe a 3-movement work or a 4-movement work. So it might get expanded in the future. But that's an example of a really sort of composed piece.
Yeah, and thanks again for sending those, because I loved hearing it. That, and I got to hear them right before, at least the first three I was able to listen to before you came by today. Mm-hmm. And and I'm going to put them on the end of this podcast so everyone gets to hear about what we're talking about, which I think is really fascinating and fun, and really fun for the audience. And I'm enjoying these tracks very much so.
Right.
I'm enjoying the melody very much and the beat of 4/4. It's easily accessible.
It's probably the only one of the set that really focuses on more traditional melodic and harmonic concepts, which is not usually the way I work. I'm attracted to electronic music because I am attracted to the timbral possibility. I think that to me, if you're going to work in electronics, one of the reasons to work with electronics and electronic music is to explore the space of sounds, of timbres, and that your music, and that the music can explore that as a compositional element, which is different than exploring it. You know, well, if you instrument your piece for Rock Band, you've got, you know, four different timbres. You know, you've got the drums and the bass and the guitar and maybe the distorted guitar and the keys, and which are doing a Hammond B3, and there's your sonic palette. You know, that's it, timbrally. And so everything is more rhythm and harmony. Anyway, in this case, in 4x4, where I'm not really exploring timbre, right, it really could be played on traditional instruments. It's not really important that other than one is sustained and one is not, it could be played on things. What I am playing with is exploring how you algorithmically, so rather than just, you know, compose a beautiful figure, I'm looking at how can I explore this sort of process by which music, you can choose notes. So the notes are all, the notes and the timing and the sequencing is all based on this sort of process. And so really the music is about a process, which you can hear as it goes through. The next piece, I think, the second piece is Mechanism. That grew out of, there was actually an Ableton challenge, which they put out a small piece of sonic material, I guess I would call it, and asked people to, using that as the primary basis of the music, you know, cut that piece of music or those sounds up and turn them into something. And so Mechanism is it's very much like old music concrete or the old tape work. It's a lot about very careful splicing. So there's like hundreds of splices in that. It's only 90 seconds long. And there's easily a couple hundred splices of different sounds going on in there, all carefully cut together. And it doesn't sound anything like the original source material. I mean, you can hear the echoes of it, but and my aim there, that really is about listening to timbre, because I take this source material and exploit what each fragment of this original recording, which is noisy and full of different noises and stuff, you know, trying to find each element and like listen to its timbre. How does it sound and what musically role does that play? And then assembling those pieces together. And so what you hear there is this sort of very cinematic cascade of different kinds of sounds and how they play off against each other and play back and forth between each other. So that piece is very much about timbral composition, you know, composing the timbre more than anything else. I mean, the melodic line in it is not particularly complex or inspiring. It just is.
That's very nice. It sounds like something I would probably enjoy, just because I've created tracks where I've just taken sound bites, you know, taken samples from like a movie quote or something like that, sampled it down until it becomes just a beat, just from, you know, the voice, and throwing it into some reverb so it actually has, you know, a bit more range than just, a short decay.
Right.
That's really nice. Now, and one of the other pieces you've sent me was a Coil Thump.
Coil Thump. So Coil Thump is probably much more representative of the kind of stuff that I do live. It's a little more traditionally rhythmic. It's a basic 4/4 thumper, hence its name. It is using a whole pile of samples of other things, which is a lot of, again, what I do because I like exploring timbre, is I love to take samples of things and carefully cut them and then use them, in this case, in a digitact sequencer or a drum sampling device. And then I can play them live as rhythms or as rhythmic music, which I really, really enjoy. In this particular case, most of those samples came from a recording of a Tesla coil. So they're extremely noisy.
Wow.
But everything in it, except for there's a bass drum, which is a recording of a different drum. But everything else in it comes from a Tesla coil, and carefully cut, spliced, edited, filtered, reverbed, manipulated, mangled. Coil Thump, the piece that you hear, is a one-take live performance. That's what you hear is exactly how I played it out. It's just straight there. And so that's the kind of stuff I tend to muck around with and do live. And it's all on a single instrument. And it's fun. You know, I enjoy funness and I enjoy a little bit of, you know, theatrical amusement. So
I really enjoyed it myself.
Yeah. The last thing I sent you, which I don't know that you've gotten through because it's a little bit longer.
Halfway through,
okay. Is so that is actually a really early rough cut. So you guys are all getting a special treat here on the podcast of one of the performances from the tour. So those have not been released yet, but the we recorded everything on tour. So I have 6 renditions of almost every piece, you know, and carefully trying to pull together a tour album out of the thing by picking the best parts. This is the tour, the last piece in the evening on tour was a thing that I call the infinite set, which is thinking about how to take improv in a longer view. So the infinite set is an improv piece where every time I perform it, I start with where the settings were and what music I was playing the last time I performed, when I ended it the last time. And so there's an album out which has the first 4 live performances, and they thread together. Each one starts where the last one ended. In this tour, we took it up again. And so the 6 perform concerts on the tour had the next 6 segments of the infinite set. I'm sorry, so 4 of them did, because we did it 4 times. This is a recording of one of those, and so it's an open improv piece in the sense that we did not have a structure or a place to go. We just knew where we were starting from, which is we were starting from where we ended the previous night's performance. And so we picked that up and took it forward. The track features really wonderful playing by Paul on keyboards. And a lot of the tonality and feeling of the piece comes from his performance and his improv, which I give him a lot of credit. It's a lot of it is him in that track. But I think the track also expresses a lot. When I do improv and play percussion with someone else, how I view that, you know, percussion forms a grid or a framework on which everything else is hung, but I like that framework to be, if you listen to just the percussion part of that piece, you'll hear it very slowly over the 10-minute, or I guess it's about 8.5, 9 minutes long, shifting around. So rather than like a traditional percussion part in most songs where you play 16 bars and then there's like a hard break and the hats drop out and, you know, things come in and out on hard boundaries, this is much more about shifting and evolving, which is a lot how I like to do improv with people. So you know, you might be listening to it and for 3 minutes you might not think the percussion has changed, but if you skip back 3 minutes you're like, oh, it's different. So, and a lot of it's about the live interplay between the two of us and listening carefully. There's a lot of careful listening in what makes that track work.
That's excellent.
So
very cool.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, I think about a question today.
Oh.
Is there anything else that we that I missed today?
Anything else you missed?
Do you want to talk about Res Freak for a minute?
I'm sorry?
Do you want to talk about resonant frequencies for a minute?
Oh, I mean, sure. I mean, I mentioned before that there were several, or there's 2 monthly events. One of them is Resonant Frequencies, which takes place in Oakland. And it's run by a wonderful guy named Kevin, who has started this because, as he said, like he wanted to be, he wanted to create the scene that he wanted there to be. And it's this, what I love about Resonant Frequencies is that its focus is entirely on live performed electronics, but it has no strictures on genre beyond that. And so as a showcase, or not a showcase, as a venue, as a monthly event, you get to hear everything from, like, you know, drone music to noise music to, you know, hard techno to, you know, sort of environmental, you know, ambient stuff. It's great. It just goes all over the map, and allows, it really creates an environment for people, or a community in which people doing live electronic work can work and grow together. It's great to hear each other. It's great to learn from each other. It's great to, I think a lot of us in the community around here now think about things like, oh, like I'm gonna workshop this at Resonant Frequencies. like oh. So I did that for this tour. There's one of the pieces I played is this piece called Tycho Space, and which uses these giant sampled Tycho drums that I play. And yeah, but I kind of put it together, and then I was like, okay, I'm gonna go take it to Resonant Frequencies and I'll perform it there and hear how it felt to play it and hear how the audience worked. So
you're right, it's Resonant Frequencies is one of those places where you're going to hear almost anything.
Yeah,
and there's, you know, the boundaries are limitless, right. And the variety of creativity of the people coming there is boundless. A couple months ago now, a friend of mine, Tobias, went over and he performed. I was just an audience member that night, and his performance was, he told everybody to take out their cell phones. Were you here for that one?
I was there for that one.
And,
yeah,
right, wasn't that great?
Cell phone performance,
and everything you heard was on your own cell phone,
right.
And it was just like different noises from the website you went to,
right.
And the whole performance was from everybody's cell phone.
Yeah,
I thought it was a fun, unique thing that he did that, you know, was working on everyone's cell phone in the mm-hmm. room at the same time.
Right. So yeah, I think it's just it's a tremendous blessing. It's a great thing that we have.
And one of the things I really enjoy mm-hmm. about Resonant Frequencies are the video projections that done by Bill Trosky and Kit Young and the other.
Other people. Yeah, right. As if the music were not enough, right? There's this amazing live electronic visual stuff going on.
What they do in there is incredible.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So, it's great. I've brought friends to come to it, to come sit through it, which is really nice. It's very open. It's free.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, it's a great thing.
It really is. It's very unique. Kevin has done a very good job of creating the scene that he wanted.
Yep.
And I think we're all very thankful for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Cool. I think, Mark, I think we've
great. Well, thanks for having me. It's been lovely talking with you.
You too, Mark. Thank you so much.